how did you kind of become this investor? And then what do you see when you see these younger investors in front of you? What advice do you give them? And what are you looking for?
When I was asked the first question of what's the most important thing in a pitch, I said,
welcome to the Superhero Academy podcast. I'm your host, Arcangelo. Hello, superheroes, and welcome to another episode of the Superhero Academy podcast, where this week I've got a guest that, actually I've known about for a very, very, very long time. And I know about him because, well, number one, I was a patron to his movie theaters all over Montreal, you know, Montreal born and raised. The man who's, you know, coming onto the show today is also a staple in the Montreal scene in every single way, shape, and form. But I used to go to Cinema Guzzo, before I introduce him, I used to go to Cinema Guzzo all the time on Tashro. And over time, I even had my own content on the screens of Cinema Guzzo because it, and Vince Guzzo, you don't know this, but I was filming Spidey the Magician and I was making all the videos that were happening and was playing before every single movie at Guzzo for, I want to say 2 years or something like that. So thank you so much, Vince, for joining in and being a guest on the show today.
Thank you for having me. By the way, where is Spidey these days? I hear he's moved up to celebrity status.
I honestly haven't. Possibly. I mean, I honestly haven't spoken to him in a long time. But I used to love going. I mean, we used to go 2 times a month. We would film behind the scenes, kind of, you know, all the we call the Guzzo magic, and it was magic tricks that were essentially done on the patrons of, you know, unsuspecting patrons of Guzzo movie theaters. It was just an amazing time. It was a lot of work. You had to have all the bright angles because when you're filming magic, it's a very important thing. But I used to remember that all my friends would go to your theaters and would talk about, wait a second, Mark, I just saw your logo on the screen. Like, what just happened there? So, you know, you've always had some big role to play in my reality. And
I travel often, and very, very often his name comes up. I was actually in the Kansas City area, and the hostess who checked me in said to me, are you the guy from the movie theater? And I said, Jesus, Kansas City, how the hell do you guys know me? She says, I used to be from Toronto, and every time I'd come to Montreal to see my boyfriend, we'd see this awkward magic trick thing beforehand. Said, yeah, you played it. She goes, that's right, that's the guy. He was great, blah, blah, blah. And I said, wow, yeah, okay.
It's amazing. I mean, look, we did it for months upon months. I think I learned a lot about magic. I also learned a lot about Guzzo theaters. I had some, you know, very good friends growing up that worked as managers at Guzzo and particularly Tashro and stuff. So I want to hear a little bit about who you are and your background. For those obviously who are joining in, if you don't recognize Vince from Montreal or from Guzzo theaters, you probably recognize him from his tag or his pseudonym, Mr. Sunshine, on Dragon's Den. So a lot of, you know, viewers here, you're Americans. I get it. I understand that it's Shark Tank over there. I understand that you think it's better and a bigger deal, but I think Dragon's Den is amazing. But I would love to hear a little bit more about your story. You know, Vince, just how did you get into the movie business? You know, has it grown over time? I mean, I can imagine the last 2 years have been an absolute struggle. I've seen, obviously, your take on some of the lockdowns and some of the challenges going on. But I'd love to hear a little bit of your story and how it brings you to where you're at today.
Yeah, so first we'll clear up Shark Tank and CBC's Dragons then. So, you know, we're at season 15, I know 17, they're at season 11, right? So we were first.
There you go.
They copied us. And the only reason why it's Shark Tank and not Dragons Den is because the Southern Belt doesn't like dragons on the biblical side. It's not. So sharks are better in that sense.
Fair.
So, you know, so a lot of people know me in the Montreal area. I mean, I'm an only child. I grew up. My dad used to own movie theaters. We owned nightclubs at a certain point. You know, I was destined to go to New York. My whole dream, a lot of people don't know this. I didn't want to be a businessman. My idea was, I saw the sacrifices my parents did, and I said, I don't want to do this. I want to be a litigator. I want to go, you know, to law school, and I want to move to New York. And I wanted to be, as I like to say, Harvey Specter before Harvey Specter even existed.
Love that. It's true. You have a law degree, or you have a law background. Yeah. And economics background too. I knew that too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Economics and law. And so the year before I was leaving to go to New York, my dad said, "Hey, you're an only child. You know, we have these 2-3 theaters. Maybe you want to give it a go at it or whatever. Or else, you know, what are we going to do? Might sell it and move to New York with you." And I said, wait. That's going to cramp my style. You're not supposed to be moving to New York. You're supposed to be going alone.
Nobody wants to move to New York with their dad.
That's right. And so basically, I gave it a shot. And oddly enough, I found more litigation and more fun arguing with U.S. studios about access to movies and so forth and so forth. And one thing led to another. And then I became, you know, executive VP. And then I eventually helped build a construction division, helped build a real estate division. And gradually then my dad, you know, stepped aside. And so I fell into the entrepreneurial space. It wasn't predestined. I didn't have people like to say, you know, at what age did you feel the entrepreneurial bug? I really didn't feel the entrepreneurial bug. I felt the bug of wanting to make money, but I didn't feel the bug of saying, I want to work, you know, 20 hours a day. And I want to be abused by every government out there and every government regulator. It wasn't my thing. Mm-hmm. But like I said, one thing led to another. And then I established myself in the business. Mm-hmm. And then it's in 1998 that Cinema Guzzo came out of its shell, as we like to say, right? I mean, our first theaters were only named after the city they were in, right? So, for example, we had a movie theater in Terban, so it was called Cinema Terban. Nobody knew who owned it. Nobody knew it was. We didn't want to upset, call it Cineplex or Famous Players, and make them think that we had imperialistic mindsets, you know. And then it's in 1998 where we said, okay, you know, the fun's over. Let's build these theaters. And, you know, Tashro, Pompeo, and DDO were the three theaters that declared war on the, what I would call a duopoly that existed between Famous Plays and Cineplex. And then all of a sudden the markets opened up and, you know, the U.S. studios still thank me today because of that, because by opening up that market, Montreal became a world city when it comes to cinema box office. And obviously, look, I mean, when we opened DDO, I'll never forget this. We played, I believe it was 6 screens of Lethal Weapon 4. And that week 1, we were number 2 in North America with the movie.
Wow.
And Warner Brothers was getting calls from other exhibitors saying, who is this guy?
You were
disrupting. DDO? What the hell is, you know, like, what is all of this? Like it's a novel approach. We didn't know other people existed apart from Cineplex and Famous Players, right? So, and that's what basically put us on the map. The other thing that we did is, you know, most of the Montreal offices in the movie industry were here because Quebec was a French-speaking province and we needed to have French people to speak to our French exhibitors. And then here I come along and speak fluent English and I head out to LA and start doing deals directly with LA. So the whole landscape changed, not necessarily positively for local movie theater offices, but on a distribution level, the Americans really enjoyed my existence because I all of a sudden had direct deals with Toronto or LA. No more needs to have these Montreal offices. So your dad, who's an entertainment lawyer, at a certain point said, "You're closing everybody down. I'm not doing anything. I'm just organizing economies of scale and making sure that we don't waste money on useless offices."
Absolutely.
And then obviously, you know, because we did lodge a complaint for anti-competitive measures and barriers to entry against Famous Players in Cineplex, that made us very famous in North America. Everybody knew about the small guy and so forth. And we did an out-of-court settlement with the studios. And that's how, you know, Cinema Guzzo started having every single movie out there. And therefore, our slogan back then was, you've chosen your movie, you should have the right to choose your theater. You know, and that made me, in a very awkward way, maybe militant, let's call it. And that's probably what started putting me on the radar for shows like CBC's Dragon's Den, where they said, you know what, we're looking for a guy from Quebec. The guy looks like he's got a big mouth. Maybe, you know, maybe keep an eye out.
Well, you're a character. I mean, it's a David and Goliath story where all of a sudden you've become another form of Goliath. Like, you've obviously grown. I mean, there's no doubt about it. The show Dragon's Den is huge. I mean, there's so much. I think it's, you know, every entrepreneur's dream to kind of go in front of a group of investors, and whether that be on Shark Tank or on Dragon's Den here in Canada, you know, being able to pitch their dream and go out into the world and bring something to the forefront. I mean, you did that. I mean, you did it with the legacy of your, you know, your father's business, adding in so many different layers, but then you did it truly on your own in terms of taking on the big players. And that's a very rare story. Like, I think I'm certain you realize how rare it is to win the fight versus the big players. What would you say to somebody who comes on Dragon's Den, who's pitching, you know, how do you tell them to take on, you know, the beginning stages of entrepreneurship? When should they take on capital? When should they pitch? What should a good pitch look like? Like, talk to me about how you became an investor now and your investor mindset and what you see when young entrepreneurs, because some like me, I've been an entrepreneur since I'm 18 years old now. But I think I had the little bug when I was a kid. In fact, my father really, you know, inspired a lot in me as well. But how did you kind of become this investor? And then what do you see when you see these younger investors in front of you? What advice do you give them? And what are you looking for?
So oddly enough, last night was Dragon's Den pitch 101. And it was Wes, myself, and Manjeet. And then there was the announcement that Robert Hrshevac is coming back to Dragon's Den for season 17. And so when I was asked the first question of what's the most important thing in a pitch, I said, you got to wear yellow. And everybody's like, what do you mean? Got to wear yellow. You want to make a deal with me. If you're not wearing yellow, I don't want to talk to you. And in fact, in a very awkward way, every deal I've done, the person was wearing something yellow. Right. So I said to them, it's a good luck charm, right?
I'll keep that in mind next time. I want to talk to you about something that I need your help for.
So kidding aside, I mean, it was a very awkward thing when I was asked to be on Dragon's Den, because my non-cinema, non-real estate investments were very private. I mean, I don't have a Guzzo holding that's known for investing in IT or investing startups in medical research or et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it was very surprising to me, but they were looking for a character. They were looking for what the movie industry would call some showmanship. And I'm probably, I would say, a handful of, you know, we're the last Mohicans of the movie industry where we're not bean counters. We're actually part of the, you know, of the whole, you know, I'll give you an example. When there's a movie being filmed in Montreal, most of the talent will say, hey, can I have a, you know, I'm not asking for dinner with them. They're saying, can I have dinner with Guzzo while I'm in Montreal? First of all, he'll bring me to a better restaurant than you guys are bringing me. And second of all, it's entertaining when I'm with the guy, right?
So, absolutely.
So that's what Dragon's Den was looking for.
Yeah.
In fact, it was almost a give and take relationship, because I went in as a showmanship and the show gave me back the visibility that I could be an investor in a various, you know, number of other businesses. So I ended up, if I invested, let's say pre Dragon's Den, if I invested in one or two businesses a year outside of my core business, that was the number. Now, because of Dragon's Den, I'm investing in 20, 30 businesses a year. Most of them come from the show. Some of them are off the show. But ultimately, you know, what I said, and I said this also yesterday, I'm more of a hands-on investor, not necessarily in the operational, but on the motivational side. So I actually speak to my partners on a monthly basis. I want to know how things are going. They can text message me, hey, you know, the deal fell through with that guy. Who can we get to try and get us through the doors? And so we're there. But the other thing I like to do is when I invest in a company, I want to understand not only the company, but the industry. Right? So it's awkward that my vocalness or my criticism of the provincial government during COVID, a lot of people didn't realize I have a lot of money invested in medical research. Mm-hmm. I was actually asked at the onset by the government to actually help them manage and give them a different perspective of how to manage the crisis. What upset me was that it almost seemed like whatever I gave as advice, they did the opposite.
I think they did the opposite of almost everyone's advice. That's right. I would say, I mean, we added no hospital beds. We've spent an enormous amount of money. We're in a deep, deep inflationary problem right now. And all of a sudden, we're, you know, our way out of it is like, let's send everyone $500. Well, I don't understand. I mean, I could go on for days on how that happened, but not to derail you. Obviously, yeah. There was COVID brought a lot of challenges. Clearly, I'm sure your payroll took a huge hit.
And what a lot of people, you know, didn't understand, and I think after a few podcasts I did on the subjects, most people got it. But there's still a lot of people who don't understand that when I say, you know, for a businessman like me to take a public stance and say to the government, you guys are a bunch of incompetent people who are not following the rules. Mm-hmm. And these guys are going out there saying, no, but we're following public health, you know, recommendations. And I say, no, you're not. And if I say that, it's not because I'm guessing it.
Yeah.
Because I actually have the recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
I actually saw, for example, in September of, 2020, the recommendation of Arruda was close the shopping malls, keep restaurants and movie theaters open. And Legault did the opposite, mm-hmm. right? And when they closed theaters down this year during the Christmas holidays, I opened the theater on the 17th of December.
Ouch.
Trust me, I'm not psychotic enough to just open a theater out of the blue mm-hmm. in the middle of COVID.
Yeah.
I basically called the offices. I made sure the PM was aware. I'm going to open a theater. Are we good? Or are you going to shut me down? Because if you're going to shut me down, don't waste my time.
Yeah.
No, we're good. Don't worry about it. We're not shutting. In fact, Mr. Gutso, we're going to go to 20 people at home. And then on the 20th... shutting everything down.
Yeah.
And it's not a secret that in every government, there are pro-government and anti-government, and there's, you know, bureaucrats that agree and disagree. And so when I asked some people in the PM's office, what's the logic for closing movie theaters? Says, well, there's no real logic. It's that, you know, we don't know what to do. We can't get a clear number on what this variant's gonna do. So we wanna look like we're proactive. So by closing movie theaters, it's the least, but at least we can say, look, we tried to do something.
Yeah, we did something. And we did something in a place where there's lots of people. But I think the thing that hits me, and I'm sure it hits you too, but I can see it obviously in your passion, is that they pretended like they had all the answers, and we can clearly see that they don't. And that's okay. Like, I think it's like, you know, it's exactly the Donald Trump approach, but I would imagine that you would say this to your own, the companies you invest in, right? You're in front of a young entrepreneur, or this entrepreneur is doing some stuff, and every once in a while, okay, they're in a meeting or in some situation, and they just don't have the answer. Wouldn't it be humble and smart on a large scale with big business and big money, let alone being a government that is governing all the rules for all the people, that is literally changing the goalposts every 5 seconds, to just every once in a while say, look, we don't know. We're doing our best. I understand that they're trying to not create panic, but it was clear to everyone that they were just inventing it, right? It's clear to everyone when you're walking into a restaurant and you put on a mask, and then you walk in and you sit down, and all of a sudden, 5 seconds ago, you had a mask on, now you don't. It's not really changing all that much, right? And so we entered this, you know, you work in the theater business. We entered into security theater. We entered into a scenario where we're pretending to know what we're doing. And that's the death of, in a world of like, of entrepreneurship. What I love about entrepreneurship, and I'm sure, again, you can feel this, is you live or die by the market. Like, you live or die by what the people of want. Yes or no? Do they want to come to your theaters? Yes or no? Do they want to buy your product? Yes or no? Do they like you versus your competitor? Yes or no? But when it comes to the government, we don't have a choice. We do
have a choice.
we sort of
have a choice every 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah,
but
sort
we
of.
We seem to forget.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, a lot of people said to me recently, they said, hey, you're going to run for leadership of the Conservative Party. I said, guys, you know, I took such a hit in the last 2 years. I'd like to re-get my family finances back to where I can say, okay, kids can't screw it up if I leave them this, right? Mm-hmm. So now I can go take care. But, you know, I know Pierre Poilievre, and he's a super nice guy.
Yeah.
But as I said to somebody today in an interview, I said, look, only because you can get up, tie your blazer, which is what you're supposed to do when you're standing up, ask a question, untie your blazer, sit down, and do that four times after Trudeau hasn't answered you your question, doesn't make you a great debater. And it doesn't mean you have any solutions. If there's one thing that our politicians have shown us in the last 2 years, is there's no humbleness in any of them.
Oh,
I mean, you know, we had one of them tell us that he knew everything and he didn't see how he could do better. What do you mean? You just have to listen to public health. And that would have been a lot better than what you did.
I think there's a lot of things that could have been done better. I think the Freedom Convoy thing was really scary. The way they you know, brought in the Emergencies Act, all that kind of stuff. I mean, who do you see? I mean, look, I think Pierre Poilievre is saying something that is very relevant to the people at the end of the day at the gas pumps and in everyday life, which is inflation is a huge problem. And we've got a government that is unchained at the moment. And now we've got a coalition between NDP and the Liberals that is making it even more unchained. And you know, for the Americans that are listening to this, obviously you've heard of, clearly, of the Freedom Convoy and all the, you know, the protest, anti mandates protests, because it's not an anti-vax thing. It's really truly anti-mandates. It's ending mandates and getting back to freedom and opening up, because at the end of the day the risks have been mitigated to some degree, and the risk now that we're facing, and I would love to hear your take on this and what we can do for inflation and maybe who are the best candidates out there at the moment. But what do we do in a runaway environment where we've printed way too much money? The price of everything is skyrocketing. And now we're just blaming it on Putin or blaming it on somebody else. So like, we're pointing the finger away when after we doubled the money supply in the last 2 years. You know what I mean? Like,
the real problem we're going to have is the following. And I think that, you know, Pierre's message resonates as an amazing slogan.
Totally.
We should spend less money. We should, you know, less government intervention. It sounds great.
Totally.
The problem is that isn't what the problem with government is. The problem with government is it wastes money. It doesn't spend money. It wastes it. Meaning what? Meaning when things are great, that's when you're supposed to be reducing your deficit. That's when you're supposed to be replenishing your savings.
Absolutely.
And regretfully, the money that was spent in the last 2 years in overpaying for medical supplies, not being prepared, no tenders for anything, and God knows how many buddies of buddies got contracts, have made it that we're over $1 trillion of deficit. Great. Now, how are we going to get out of this? Regretfully, the next guy who wants to really get out of this, he's probably going to have to throw $500 million to it by saying, I got to put people back to work. And the only place I can invest is in infrastructure, right? And so all of a sudden, people don't realize that by doing that, what happens is the government's saying, I'm going to employ 100,000, 200,000 Canadians as my employees indirectly through corporations. Where the problem is going to be is that's going to create a boom. That's going to alleviate inflation. But then we're going to be upset at him because he actually had to make the tough decisions. And then we're going to re-elect a guy who's going to be a free spender again. And then all of a sudden you go, but guys, now's when you're supposed to be putting the money aside, right? So people need to understand that my position, at least what I consider to be a prudent conservative, is we must have the empathy to spend money when it is needed. To spend money when it's needed, I have to have the money. To have the money, that means I got to save it when I can and not freely give money away just for the pleasure of wanting to give money away, right? The same thing with, for example, a carbon tax. You want to put a carbon tax? Okay. What are we doing with that money? What's really being done with the carbon tax money? What should happen with that money is it should have been given back to research facilities to find better ways of using oil and other sources of energy in a more efficient, less pollutant way. But no, what we did is we took it, we put it in the lump sum aggregate amount of money that we want to spend, and we said, look, we got extra money to just flow the money. The same thing with, you know, Canada gave $435 million to Quebec to buy ventilators. And we bought $35 million worth because under a sanitary emergency, we can allocate money where we want. So now we have $400 million that's been allocated to what? Whatever to advertising, to alcohol, a pot, or what? You know, so I need people to understand that, and somebody said this on social media. He said, I don't care that Mr. Gutzel lost $14 million. He's got the money. He can afford it. Mm. And then I answered him and I said, you do realize that if I lose $14 million, that gives me a $14 million
tax
income tax credit, which means for the next 2 years,
no tax money is coming in.
I'm not helping hospitals. I'm not helping the infrastructure. You're going to get that $14 million somewhere else. I mean, I'm not really losing the money because I can defer it 25 years in the future. So I'm good. But the truth of the matter is, and I had said, look, I had said to the federal government, because as much as I can be seen as a competitor, they know that I'm a solutions guy. So I got the call and said, look, we're looking at doing this wage subsidy. You know, this is what we want to do. What do you think? So I think it's a bad idea. What you should do is you should give me the money to continue paying my employees. Mm. Don't pay my employees directly.
Because then they'll all quit and we created a labor issue.
There you go.
Yeah.
Because now you created a link to you and not to me.
Yeah.
Right? I would have kept them working. I would have found something to do. Because remember, I get no money if I'm not paying them.
Yeah.
So even if they were paying me 100% of the salary, I still had a link with my employees.
And it should have been retroactive in the sense that you'd pay and then they'd pay you back. The government pay you back rather than handing out willy-nilly to everyone.
That's right. Because you have to remember, I have employees, most of my part-time employees make about $200, $300 a week. Mm-hmm. They're part-timers. They're students, right? They work 20 hours a week, let's say.
Yeah.
You're now giving them $500 a week. You're doubling their salary. They're saying, I'm not going to, why do I have to go to work?
Of course.
I'm good. And the problem is that nobody bothered to explain to people, by the way, that $500 is taxable income. Now a lot of them are trying to come back and say, hey, you know, like I got to find a way to resolve my income tax issue. Or their fathers or parents, because many of them put themselves on their parents' income. You see, so that's where we need to understand. The same thing with the $500, right?
Yeah.
You want to give $500. Okay. But doesn't anybody see the awkwardness and the timing? I'm going to use $500 five months before an election.
Absolutely.
No, I'm not buying the election, by the way. I just happen to have $3.2 billion, right? And I want to give it out to people who make less than $100,000.
And it's all for you. Right. Yeah, it's all for you. Not, yeah.
And no, we're not trying to convince anybody.
No, zero.
To vote for us again, right? And once again, at the end of the day, it was a crisis situation. Perfect. I agree. So who handles crises better than entrepreneur?
Nobody.
You know,
I'm putting out fires every day. That's what I do. I feel like I literally full-time entrepreneur, part-time firefighter. It's part of the job.
Entrepreneurs in the same week go from thinking they own the world to thinking they wanted to kill themselves because it's the world had just ended as they know it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the emotions that entrepreneurs go through makes them resilient to the point. I mean, I do it all the time. I tell myself, it's okay. It's one of those days. I'm in hell. What do you do when you're in hell? Keep on walking, my friend. You don't want to stay there. You keep on walking and you're going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we have the worst record of any province in Canada. And we have this nonchalance or this pretension of saying, we're the best. And, we don't want any pipelines passing through Quebec, But we do want the $13 billion of transfer payments, right?
Of course.
And so somewhere along the way, I think we need politicians to come back and say, look, people are not ignorant. They're actually more educated today than they ever were in the history of the world. So you can speak to us. You can tell us why is it exactly that we have to do this or not do this, right? And instead of just say no, for example, right? I mean, I say this to some of my conservative colleagues. They say, what's the problem again with a firearm registry? Just remind me what the problem was. They say, well, you know, my freedom of my rights to have fire. No, nobody's taking your rights away. I want to know what's the problem. Think about this. You register your car. You register your home. For God's sake, you register your kids when they're born. Think about it. You register them, right? Sure. Why wouldn't you register your firearms? Now, I registered my firearms under the Quebec registry. Mm-hmm. What I hadn't realized and what I was surprised about is that that's a registry that is publicly accessible by more than just the police. Now I have a problem.
Now, everyone.
Now I'm saying, wait up a minute, that the government knows that I have a collection of firearms because I shoot trap or whatever. I'm good. But I have no problem.
Sure.
Policemen are going to come to my house. They need to know if they're going into a danger zone. I understand. But why does my neighbor have to know?
But here's the thing is, if Microsoft can get hacked, okay, and then we made the Vax Pass thing, and then that got hacked within minutes, we're talking here, okay? This is like, oh, it's super safe and super secure. Bang, here's your information. And now we're heading towards this world. Like, look, I don't know where you stand on this. I'm gonna throw it out there. I'm sure you've seen the storylines of World Economic Forum and all this whole like you'll own nothing and you'll be happy kind of mentality. I mean, it seems like the world is shifting more and more and more towards big government, kind of UBI, universal basic income, spend a lot, kind of create a huge deficit, and then say you don't know what's best for you because there's going to be all these big challenges that are communal in nature, climate change being one of them, coronavirus being another. So we just leave us to control. And let's put all your information over here and let's go towards what I think is happening. And I think it's inevitable at this point, a social credit system of sorts, like the one we see in China. I mean, is that conspiracy theory? Like where do you land when you hear this? I mean, it seems like it's happening.
So the problem I think is the following. So you'll notice for the last 20 years or so, tech companies have been valued on
their data,
more on the data that they hold than really any hard asset that they have, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I remember one day having a discussion with Michelle and saying to her, you know, Michelle was on Dragon's Den with me and said to her, I said, Michelle, why is the data of my Fidelity card holders so valuable? She goes, well, Vince, think about it. You get to see what they do. They don't do. Okay, I understand. But what's so important about the data from 10 years ago? Well, you know, you get historic perspective. You're not getting it. 10 years ago, that 18-year-old is now 28. I know nothing about that 18-year-old anymore because he's now 28. Mm-hmm. And the 18-year-old of today is not that guy anymore, mm-hmm. right? And all of this came because we were having a discussion on how somebody tried to steal my identity in Montreal, to boot, imagine to you. So somebody went to a local store with a credit card with my name on it.
And wow. The
store teller said, you look nothing like Vince Gupta. I'm sorry, but you don't. And I couldn't understand how I was, you know, how my identity had been. And then I realized that about a year earlier, Desjardins had been hacked. Mm-hmm. And there had been 9 million accounts or whatever. 32 years ago, I used to have an account at a Desjardins branch.
And they had got your info.
And they got my info. But I was sitting there and saying, but why do you have my information for 32 years ago? Right? And they were trying to tell me, but it's valid information. No, because when I was 20, I'm 52 today. I'm not going to behave in any way like that guy. Who do you think's behaving? You know, so for now, I think that that's been repeated and they've understood that enough that now they're saying, okay, how can I keep current data to try and anticipate people's behavior?
Yeah.
But we're not robots. You're not supposed to anticipate my behavior.
We're predictable, though. We're predictably irrational. I mean, if you look at, like, you mentioned Michelle, if you look at what ClearBank is doing, I mean, at the end of the day, there's the play of finance. It's a great financing play. It's amazing for entrepreneurs. Yeah. Many entrepreneurs can find finance. If you don't know what ClearBank does, or I think it's now called Clear,
ClearCo.
ClearCo, yeah, sorry. Yeah. So, they fund people's Facebook ad funnels or their online funnels, right? So let's say you have an online store, it's doing really well, but now you want to scale. There's two ways to scale. You go and get venture, you know, funds, or you go on Dragon's Den and pitch to a dragon or a shark on
Shark
Tank. Yeah, you sell equity, exactly. Yeah. You do something like that. I would actually add a third one now, which is DeFi, right? We've got the whole world of Web 3.0, and I would love to hear your thoughts actually a little bit on like the future. And I want to spend, you know, some of this the rest of this podcast talking about, you know, where you think things are going. But the interesting thing is that they fund these funnels, and a lot of product is moved through Facebook ads, Instagram ads, and I would even say now Google ads or YouTube Google ads and even TikTok ads and other ads are starting to catch up. But at the end of the, behind all of that, beyond the money that's flowing through the system and them taking a cut without taking a percentage of your company and any equity in your company, great financing option. I think it's phenomenal. The hidden play at ClearCo is that they're probably getting access to all that data. They're understanding consumer trends in a big, powerful way. They're getting access to what people are buying and where the puck is moving. And Amazon was accused of this. We're going to wait and see who all our sellers are going to sell. And then eventually we're going to make Amazon Basics and now compete them. And they say they don't do it, but they got caught doing it in India. I mean, look, how do you not, right? Data is super powerful. And we're in a world right now where the data and the misinformation and or the information is being limited or decided on social media platforms, and what the truth is and who gets to speak that truth is insane. I mean, it's remarkable. Like even when we were talking about this and we mentioned COVID, I'm like, ooh, yeah, maybe that my algorithm is going to take a dip when I publish this. You know what I mean? Like it's amazing that algorithm problem is a thing. And this data is super valuable.
But the problem where the real problem is if you think about the people that are concerned about their information being easily accessible by others, they're the ones behaving in a way that they don't even realize that they're giving the information. And I'll give you an example, right? I was arguing with my wife, and all of a sudden her phone said, would you like me to suggest you a series of therapists?
Wow. Really?
And I said, what the hell was that? She goes, I don't know. And we were like all stunned. And then she realized it was Siri.
Oh,
how the hell did Siri pull that stunt off?
Wow.
And so my wife's in psychology. What my wife didn't realize is she had put her phone next to her computer during, she's doing some PhD studies.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the computer was basically just ingesting her classes. And it eventually realized, hey, there's an argument. Maybe I can suggest a psychologist for you guys to like not argue.
Wow.
And I said, like, it's insane. The same way I have one of my employees comes into me one day and he says, isn't that cool? We were talking about Tom Brown, you know, the designer the other day, right? I went home at night, I opened up my Instagram, and all of a sudden I got these Tom Brown ads. Do you think that's cool?
Yeah. I don't. I do not.
I don't think that's cool, buddy. Let me put your Siri on. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I don't have my Siri on. Because at a certain point, we don't realize, you know, even when we go on Google, right? I mean, we're searching something, and all of a sudden I got these ads.
Yep.
And they're from Tom Brown. They're from Ralph Lauren. All of a sudden, all of the places I've been shopping at in the last 4 days, they all reappear and they're repushing the ad.
Yep.
So when somebody says to me, you know, the government wants to know if you've been vaccinated or not. Really? That's what's bothering you? Because I think there's private corporations who know way more about you than you think. And they're using it to guide you a certain way.
There's persuasion. It's called persuasion in the world of marketing, right? And we have blatant persuasion when we go to the Guzzo Theater and you watch a trailer, Right, so there, or Spidey, Guzzo Magic is persuasion. Okay, it was sponsored by Parasuco. So the idea is that ads have always been a portion of what the internet and content is fueled by. I mean, now the ads are literally in the movies these days, right? A Coca-Cola ad or a Heineken ad in a James Bond film now, of course, or whatever it is, right? So they're there. I mean, ads have always been there. There's a lot of money, actually, that goes into even the NFL and movies where the government, the military will fund, you know, making movies about war or glorifying kind of elements of war, elements of heroism of sorts. I mean, like, we are constantly being nudged or persuaded is the right word here in particular directions. But I'm curious about where you think some of this is going. Like, what's the future of movie theaters today? Like, I mean, we obviously you've seen the rise of NFTs and cryptocurrencies. You've obviously heard about the metaverse and all these different things. Like, where are you at? And I'll just share a little bit of my thoughts real quick. It's like, I think that the world is zigging in a particular way, right? Like, that zig is towards the metaverse, towards data, everything being public. We're kind of entering this more of a communal public domain. And that's great in some capacities. It's very interesting in some capacities. But I'm of the mind of zagging. I'm actually investing fully in a farm. I've been running an 88-acre property 20 minutes away from downtown Montreal. We're growing food, but we're doing it in a permaculture kind of way. But we're more importantly, I would say that we're an incubator for entrepreneurship. We're an incubator for people's ideas and for literally like seed capital or seed investments and a kind of an incubator state, almost like a greenhouse, for ideas to kind of come up and flourish. Where do you see things going? I'm going towards like, let's run to the farm. What are you doing?
Right. So we don't realize it because humanity it's got a timeline that's fairly short. But if you were to take the overall timeline, you'll notice that evolution has always been that way. It's always been, this looks barbaric. We're going to go towards a better world. Which means we have to give up some of our personal individual rights for the collective well-being of all until it gets to a point where, okay, now it's enough. And then you have a mini revolution that says, no, we're going back to humanity. I have my rights. I have this. I have that, right? So I always tell people, and people like to complain about the Americans and their big V8s and big engines and gas guzzlers and whatever. I say to them, you do realize that there is no people in the world that are okay with driving 1 hour to go to a movie theater like Americans. Like, you know, when you talk to an American and they tell you it takes me an hour and a half to go to work in the morning. Shit, there's that much. I said something. Shit, there's that much traffic from your house to, oh, no. I live in that. Holy cow, that's like, why would you live that far from where you work? So I know I have no problem driving an hour and a half in no traffic. Holy cow, every day? Why, an hour and a half to go? That's 3 hours a day. I got no problem with that, right? When you sit down and you analyze the American culture, vehicles represent liberty, freedom.
Absolutely.
Right? So when you tell an American, give up your gas guzzler and be more community-minded and take the subway or take the bus. He says, what are you crazy? You want me to be on a train that somebody else is going to determine when I leave and when I... No, I don't want to do that. I want my freedom, right? And believe it or not, I think COVID has precipitated what would have gone smoother. So we would have reached what I call a peak of online sales probably in 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I think we've reached the peak of online sales. And the reason why I say that is because when you have a stock like Shopify at $2,000, who's now sitting at $600, somebody's saying, I think we reached the peak. I think we're not going to. Why? Because I think there's going to be a pushback. So, for example, I'll buy, you know, I just bought on Amazon a side screen for my laptop, right? But I don't know. I'm not buying online clothes, right? I mean, I went to Mexico on vacation. On the way back, I stopped by New York City, went to see Tom Brown, spent a few days with him, had fun, took my clothes that I needed for the show, and I'm back because I got to try it on, right? I mean, and people need to go back to experiencing, right? When you go to the movies, it's not only about the story. It's about the experience. Mm-hmm. You go there, you're sitting down, you're watching the movie, the sound is, right? And I have people tell me, oh, but I have my own home theater. Yeah, good for you. You know, okay. So you got a 70, you got a 70 inch screen, big ticket. I got a 70 foot screen. How's about that? You know, mm-hmm. like, ooh, it's all about size. But the truth of the matter is not that. What it is that I'm all alone. And this happens to me often. Okay. I work really late at night. So mm-hmm. sometimes I got the TV on and there's reruns of Seinfeld.
Mm.
They're funny, but they're not that funny. But then again, I'm alone. But when I'm watching it with the kids, it's a contagious
laughter.
Laughing. Mm-hmm. They laugh, you laugh, everybody, it's over, right? And so my best, I guess, one of my favorite lines is, online shopping is convenient, but it's not sexy.
Mm.
I said, imagine yourself when you online shop. You're probably in your dirty underwears or your dirty sweatpants and you haven't changed your t-shirt in 3 days and you don't care because you haven't left the house in 3 days. Who cares? And you're buying away, right? Mm-hmm. And that avatar of you is probably the best, most touched up picture you have in your whole phone to make you look like a Tinder star type of thing. Right?
Smooth your skin and everything. Yeah.
Right. Versus now you've got to go shopping. Now you've got to go and buy something. Now you've got to go and so now you got to get dressed. You got to, and whether we like it or not, I want to make sure I look half decent. I don't look like a schlep or whatever. And that's why people make it a trip and they go to New York City for a shopping weekend. And that's why they go to Vegas for a bachelorette party because it's the experience we want to live, right? So one of the funniest thing in the world, somebody said to me, oh man, this COVID thing's driving me crazy. It stalled my wedding by 2 years. Okay. You're married in a year from now. Okay. He says, yeah, you know, like, I mean, I couldn't even have a bachelor party, you know, or anything. Why? You wanted to have a Zoom bachelor party or something? Like, what exactly did you want to do? I'm not getting what you think you're going to get out of. And so if people realize that even this whole world of virtual reality that, you know, we think we're going to get in a machine and guys, whether we like it or not, our structure, our DNA is done in a way that we're humans. With all of the flaws of being humans and with all of the greatness of being humans, right? The advancement, you know, I always like to say the advancement of humanity is the result of greed. And people say, here we go. You know, Wall Street all over again. I said, no, think about it. I said, you really think a researcher in his lab trying to find the cure for cancer, you really think that guy's doing it as a communist was only for the well-being of society? You don't think there's any ego in there and he wants to be the first one and he wants to save the world, but he also wants to be the guy to go down in the history books as
a hero.
We
want to be
cancer,
a hero. Right? We watched movies and we learned about American culture. And I say American culture, it's worldwide culture. I mean, China is a huge movie market now and they have, you know, their own version of heroism and their own version of what a hero looks like. in a Chinese context, that heroism tends to be communally focused and nature focused. In America and in American culture, it is individually focused. We have a culture of celebrating individuality. And Canada, we tend to dampen that a lot. Like I've always said, you know, in Montreal, I feel like we have a culture of a lot of broke entrepreneurship and broke, like we don't have the same mentality of truly investing and taking risk over a longer time frame as well, right? Look, so many of the companies that have become juggernauts were not profit focused for the longest time. Amazon, a perfect example. I mean, there's so much more vision when you take a longer term time scale, a longer term view of the world. Now, for me as an investor, as an entrepreneur, look, I've been, you know, April 1st, I'm going into my 16th year of being an entrepreneur. Everything I've decided now when it comes to investing in things is I approach everything from a long-term perspective. How can I invest in people, I invest in technology that I can see and ideas that I can see are longer term, and I invest in community because I understand, I think now like an ecosystem. Right? A fruit tree isn't a fruit tree without all the other things that are necessary for it to grow.
Right.
And I would love to know what your investment strategy is. Where are you now? Where are you seeing? Like, where would you deploy money, capital, right here, right now? Because I think there's a lot of people watching this that are saying, look, I think the lockdowns are going to come back in November. Maybe I shouldn't open up a brick and mortar. Maybe I should go towards the metaverse. I think other people are like, you know what? We should run and, you know, buy land elsewhere. Maybe we should sell real estate now because it's too high. I mean, inflation's running rampant. Maybe we should buy real things. I just launched garlic NFTs and real world asset NFTs that I see as commodities and ways for people to engage in that. I mean, I'm trying to innovate here, but honestly, I can't. It's so unpredictable at the moment that it feels difficult to do. With your wisdom, where you're at, what are you seeing? Where would you deploy your capital right now?
But I just want to point out something. Remember before when we were talking about the pendulum going towards a highly controlled society? So look at cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency is totally against the grind when it comes to government control.
Of course.
Right? So what's funny for me sometimes is there's a whole segment of the population who doesn't realize that they're part of the control system. They don't feel control, but they don't realize that they are. And then when you talk to them about cryptocurrency, then they get worried. And then they say, well, yeah, but there's no control. Yeah, I know, but I thought you didn't want to be controlled. Because if you do want to be controlled, just continue. Right? And so people need to understand. I think while people are way more educated today, scholastically educated, I think people don't ask enough questions. And I'll give you the best example. During the election when Andrew Scheer was leader of the Conservative Party, I went to Calgary for about 48 hours. I had to go, you know, motivate some troops and make sure that things got done properly. And a high-powered exec in the oil business had heard me say that I was a big investor in oil. I loved oil. I have no problem with oil. And so he thought he would take me over their facilities in the Canadian tar sands. And so, we got down with the helicopter. It was very impressive. And then I said to him, let me understand something. This is like a volcano spewing out lava, right? So it's like an underground volcano spewing out oil. Yeah. And if you don't extract the oil, it's going to rise to the top. It's going to go into our water stream. It's going to go through the various underground veins and end up in water source. Yeah. So this is not us abusing the system and taking dirty oil. This is us having an environmental cleanup. And he looked at me and he said, well, we should hire you to fix this one.
You should be on their PR
team. That's what it is. I said, but that's what it is. Why is Exxon Valdez allowed to drop 100 million liters of oil in the middle of the ocean and they can contain it and pump it back out and resell it? And why couldn't Alberta say, we got a problem, it's rising. We're not stopping it from rising, right?
Yeah.
And so from there, remember, I have five kids. My daughter's 11 and my oldest is 23 or 24. So I have all the spectrum and I have all, I've got, the environmental contest. I got
I'm sure.
Right. And so when I hear people in general say oil is the devil, this is, guys, do you know how many places you find oil? So everybody associates oil to cars. Okay. So somebody one day says to me, I don't believe in plastic. It pollutes the world. No, plastic doesn't pollute the world. Humans disposing of the plastic inappropriately pollutes the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'd rather still have a glass bottle. But you do know that to have the glass bottle, you need to have a flame to burn the crystal sand and whatever, and to make glass, right? Right. And the only way you can get to that kind of level of heat is by burning gas and oil. Well, no, I mean, you can do it with hydroelectricity. Yeah. In your dreams, maybe. Right. The same way when Quebecers tell me, why would we want a pipeline going through Quebec? There's 9 of them already going under the St. Lawrence River, guys. What are you kidding me? You don't know. First of all, second of all, hydroelectricity may be clean, but that's after it's buried hundreds of thousands of acres a forest underwater.
Sure, yeah. The environmental damage was done, you know, decades ago, and now it's clean, but it wasn't at the time. So is your mindset that we need to invest in more energy?
I think we need to better balance the usage of energy. In other words, I've recently been heard saying that I wouldn't pass one pipeline, I'd pass two of them. One going through Quebec from Alberta and one from Quebec going to Alberta, bringing back hydroelectricity. And I would tell Alberta, let's do a deal. We'll let your oil pass. We'll take the transfer payments. We'll do it. But we'll use hydroelectricity where it is the most efficient so that we spend less gas uselessly. In other words, when I heard that in some cities it's cheaper to have generators burn gasoline to power streetlights versus using hydroelectricity, but they don't have any. I'll give you the hydroelectricity from Quebec, okay? Instead of selling it at a rebate to the Americans, I'll sell it to you at a rebate, pass your oil. And you have to remember that whether, you know, one of the awkward things about oil and the pipeline in Quebec is we have one of the biggest oil and train catastrophes in Quebec with Lac-Mégantic. I mean, 80 odd people died. A whole city was decimated.
Yeah, train disaster.
I can't even believe that we're still passing through that city with a train full of oil. I'm going, I just don't get it. And to boot, it's not even our oil. It's actually oil we've imported. And so,
well, we're learning this lesson very hard right now. I mean, you're seeing the situation with Putin and Ukraine, obviously.
But that's where we need to, as you know, you're younger than I, but I can't really say your generation because you're not that much younger than me. But the younger generation. But
I think my generation has to step up and understand this. I think that we've got a holier-than-thou mentality, and we've got unrealistic ideals. And I'll be the first to admit it. When I started the farm, I was like, okay, well, you know, every time we point a finger, there's three pointing back at us, and we have to rebuild the revolution. And we have to kind of, I had this mentality of everything had to be powered by us. We had to like build our own ecosystem, almost build our own governance system, power, water, electricity, I mean, food, whatever it was. Right. And I see a lot of value in that. But what I also see in that is a lot of inefficiency then too. And I've come to understand that like we actually do need oil, and we do need some of these other things. And Germany, in my opinion, did need and still needs nuclear, because look at what's happening now in the situation with the oil pipelines that are coming out of Russia that allow people to bully. And we have to understand that if we had spent so much more money building infrastructure, where you talk about build back better, right? And the whole build back better that's championed all over the world. Well, fine, let's invest in infrastructure like giant solar fields. Yes, let's invest in clean energy. But then to do that, we also have to invest in batteries. For do that, we have to invest in some of the other things, right? And we have to be mindful that we have to apply some level of, like, I love what Elon Musk does with this, is first principles thinking. Like, how we have to be practical about what gets us there. We have to be practical and real about that.
See, the fact of the matter, like I said, for me, what's key is I don't think the generation, the up-and-coming generation, asks enough questions. I think they just, whatever you tell them, they agree. And they just say, oh, yeah, that's the way it is. And that's political correctness. You know, so I said something to somebody recently. I said, we're being told that we've got to be more tolerant towards diversity. Why aren't we as tolerant towards ignorance as well? I mean, there's a lot of ignorant people out there. So we shouldn't crucify somebody for having made a mistake. We should be tolerant. Say, okay, look, you made a mistake. That's unacceptable here. Whatever, whatever, right? And so what I always like to tell people, I say to them, I go, look, guys, you know why Quebec is a different economically, financially, we're a bit of a catastrophe? Everybody says, well, because everybody's stealing money, because that's the way Quebec politics.
They'll blame the Italians. They'll blame the construction industry and the potholes.
Construction scandals and whatever, right?
Yeah, totally.
So I said, no, it's because we have to deal with culture protection. What do you mean? We have to spend a few billion dollars a year giving the impression that by cocooning ourselves, we're going to protect the French language. Now, that money can't be spent in hospitals. It can't be spent on infrastructure. It's got to be spent on protecting this fictitious world that supposedly our numbers are going to get better if we just isolate ourselves and piss off every Anglo and Allophone in the province so that they leave the province, right? Versus, I said to people, why don't we turn around to Ottawa and say, guys, we're supposedly a bilingual country. Yeah. Can you show me the data that shows me that there's an increasing number of bilingual people in the rest of the country? Because that's what I think Quebec should do. Quebec shouldn't say, we're going to pay to isolate Quebec.
Yeah.
It should say, we're going to
pay to make people to understand more French.
That's right. Yeah. And today, I don't think people want empathy today. I think people just want to be understood, which is different. Empathy is almost like, I feel bad for you. Canadians don't want to be felt bad for. Canadians just want somebody to say, you know what? I get it. I understand why you're frustrated, Alberta. I get it. I understand that we treat you because you wear cowboy hats. The guys in Toronto and Montreal think you guys are a bunch of hicks and that you're really, you know, like a bunch of Texans. We get it. We're sorry. Apologize. But and so we're not being allowed to communicate because the new wave of politicians is telling us, deliver a message that the polls can gauge. Mm-hmm. Don't make it complicated because the polls can't gauge that, right? You've got to have a one-liner. How does this one-liner go? Does it work? Oh, yeah, yeah, you got 80% approval if you say that.
Well, that's the way we've seen it work, and now it's becoming the way that they're moving forward with it. Like, Trump ushered in, like it or not, he was a character. Just, you know, you're a TV personality. He was a TV personality. He was also an investor and an entrepreneur and all these other things. But he was a TV personality that brought a kind of a bull in a china shop kind of like mentality. And hate him or love him, I'm not here to judge him or judge Republicans or Democrats in any one way, shape, or form. He brought forward that, like, if you just say it enough, if you repeat it enough and you really focus on, like, what the trend is and where the exact poll number is, that is going to be popular and that's what's going to work, right? And, like, that wins an election 51-49. And every election is somehow won 51-49, which is fascinating to me. But the idea being, you know, we think that we are novel thinking humans, that we don't follow the herds, that we're all part of heroes of our own journey and all that stuff. And I think that that's, you know, to some degree true, and I think it should be celebrated for sure in entrepreneurship. But I'm of the mind where, you know, and I guess this is a conservative value, even though I'm a very left-leaning in all social side of things, I'm of the mind that the private sector is just going to do it better. And I think the private sector needs to be regulated. I think the private sector's job is to be like, oh, wait a second, there's the line here. And I think that we cross it a million times over. I mean, I don't see reason for boosters or fourth doses. I just see it as money grabs at this point. I do understand vaccination. I do understand corporations showing up, because if the government had to do that, we would have failed it. We would have never gotten there. We've been still in lockdowns right now. And I do think they're coming back. But the idea being, we do need to celebrate and we need to innovate entrepreneurship more. We need better funding. And I think that that's what Quebec needs more than anything. I think Montreal
You realize that in a very, very awkward way. And I remember clearing this up with a few people. You know, every once in a while people say, you know, I don't get it. Why should I get vaccinated? I mean, people still get COVID if you get vaccinated. I said, yeah, but nobody said you wouldn't get COVID. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's what they said. No. What they said is, which is worse. What they said, according to me, is worse.
What they said didn't work. Yeah.
But basically what they said is, if you get vaccinated, you're going to be less sick and you won't have to go to the hospital, so you won't create a problem in our healthcare system.
You'll stop the spread.
So I'm sitting there and I'm saying, okay, so let me understand it. Because you didn't manage your business properly, you're forcing everybody to get back. You're not even forcing everybody to get vaccinated. You are mind fucking everybody.
You are literally creating psychological warfare, in my personal opinion.
That's right, to get vaccinated, because you got to remember, they could have imposed vaccination.
Sure.
Under sanitary emergency, rule number one, they're allowed to force vaccination. They didn't do it because they didn't want to look like, and they didn't want to get contested on that. But what I still can't believe is because the same politicians that were there 30 years ago did a shitty job taking care of the healthcare system, we're now going to shut down everybody else.
Yes.
Because we can't manage the crisis.
We used to have 6.8 beds per 1,000 citizens, and now we have 2.5 in 1984 to 2020, okay? That is the problem. The problem is we've been grossly underspending in healthcare forever while having an aging population. That was the issue. The entire shutdown was to flatten the curve so that people could get to the hospital and get the healthcare that they needed so they had the best possible chance of living. Okay?
That's right.
We've done the work for that at this point. Now, to mandate goalpost changes or continuous doses or vax passports or all these other things is now just, at this point, is becoming government overreach. And all the conspiracy theorists out there might, you know, hate or love it one way or the other. Look, I think vaccines are supportive in many ways. I think they were a solution for some and they're not a solution for others. I understand why people don't trust one way or the other. I understand why people don't trust Big Pharma. Why should they? You know what I mean? Like, there's no other track record or other drug that I think is that trustworthy. And at the exact same time, there are tons of drugs that work all the time, right? Like when people have a headache and they're like, ah, just throw me the Tylenol bottle. All of a sudden, now that's when they trust it, right? So I think we're hypocrites in so many different ways, right? And our values, we don't know how to go about them. But I do think that it's what we've had is an erosion of trust in media. We've had an erosion, therefore, in trust in politicians because our media has now become bite-sized. Make America great again, build back better, whatever. Again, I'm not trying to attack any side of the aisle here. The idea being we've just oversimplified problems and we're trying to say that it's a one-size-fits-all solution in every direction and that doesn't work that way.
So the whole idea is it's in the name of political correctness.
Sure.
See, you can't,
do it for your grandma. Do it for this
thing. That's right. That's right. Right. And so, because if we go back to Trump, you'd be surprised. I have not heard one media outlet say what I'm going to tell you. Mm. Everybody said he's crazy, he's this, he's that, or we love him. I instead said, did you guys realize that the first election that he won, nobody knew how crazy he could be. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew how unpresidential he could be in his behavior. Yet the second time around, after 4 years of the rhetoric and all that, there's still 5-6 million more Americans that voted for him.
Oh, absolutely. He had more votes.
So I sat there and I said to myself, does everybody realize there is anger? There is frustration.
Absolutely.
In the average American who's saying, I don't care if what he's saying sounds wrong or makes him look crazy. I'm frustrated. I got to get it out there. I'm sick and tired of being told by the left, stop, you're not allowed to say that. It makes people feel bad or whatever. Look, you know, every once in a while, like I said, I have 5 kids. So, you know, people would tell me, oh, you know, your son, he doesn't look happy. You know, it's okay. He'll get over it. It'll build some resilience. Life yep. isn't about always being happy, right? I told a teacher once, you know, he said to me, he says, you know, one of your sons, every time I see him, he never smiles. Maybe he doesn't like you. I go, what do you mean? Maybe he doesn't like you.
What does that have to do with me? You're an Italian father if I've ever encountered one. I love it.
What the hell are you calling me up and telling me my son doesn't smile at you? Who cares? Yeah, he's going through a hormonal growth, okay? He's got, like, internal issues. Leave me alone.
That's part of adulthood. That's what happens. What happens? Are we always supposed to be happy all the time? You know what I mean? Yeah. There's so many things I could say.
Look, you're Italian, right? You know it. If some guy's always smiling, always happy,
he's the crazy one. He's the one I'm worried about.
He must be on some happy pills. He's crazy.
Yeah.
So, at the end of the day, right? And I can tell you this. I never would have thought that the first 50 years of my life were preparing me for the last 2 years of my life. But I know people who have killed themselves the last 2 years. But I never thought they were going to crack. Mm. But they did. And I can tell you that every time I'm like, wow, man, this is rough. This is hard. I'd say, you know what? It's okay. Continue walking, man. You can do this. We can get out of this crap. We can rebuild what we lost. right? Because the truth of the matter is, people need to realize we're invincible at 20. We own the world at 30. We start being a little concerned at 40 because now we have kids. And we say, what are we leaving them? Mm. At 50, I'm lucky. But at 50, the back aches, this, that, the first cancer scare comes along. You know,
Heart attack.
A tumor here. We don't know if it's benign. You know, so psychologically, it works on you. But to realize that, hey, you know what? I'm an only child. I've stood up against three brothers. I fought off three, you know, neighbors that were brothers. That's built the character. The fact that I stood up and would tell teachers, hey, I'm sorry, man. You're my teacher, but it doesn't give you the right to disrespect me. Mm. So, you know, so, and it's sort of, instead of saying, you can't say that. What do you mean I can't say that? The truth of the matter is, the U.S. is angry. Absolutely. What are they angry about? That's the question that we should, right? But nobody wants to talk about that. Nobody wants to talk about
it's because they're selling them the anger. Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, all these places are selling them the anger. That's, they're getting paid for the anger. What goes viral is awe-spiring and enraging. And enraging goes viral significantly more than awe-spiring, I'll tell you that, okay? So you know, I'm a marketing guy. And, you know, I want to wrap this up. I want to respect your time. We're over time here. I know you might have something else. But the you know, here's what I'll say. I'm impressed with the fact. Look, you're a man of distinguished taste, I'll say that. And you're definitely, you obviously have had a lot of success. You've obviously have the capacity to cross the border, go south with the land of opportunity, which no doubt about the fact that it's better capitalized. And there's a million reasons why you would have left Quebec. There's a million reasons why you would have taken your media empire or your cinema empire and all the other investments that you have and left this place. And there's a million reasons I would have done the same too. You know, most of my clients, most of my network is in America. But I learned over time, and this is why I'm trying to do these podcasts in person as much as possible here in Montreal, is that I really love this city. I really love this country. I really love this province. I really love, as crazy and wild, as insane as it sometimes is, you know, it's not like there's more sanity elsewhere. You know, I love the dose of this insanity, I guess.
And you're right to do that parallel because what I think people need to realize as Canadians, and Quebecers are good at this. Mm-hmm. We like to look down south and laugh at them and say, look at them, look at that. Look at those Americans. They're like trailer trash. Ha ha ha. And we laugh about them.
Yep.
Then sometimes I say, guys, look in this mirror. Yeah. What do you see?
The same thing.
What do you mean? And I said, think about it. Think of the politicians we've had. Think of the way we're closer to being Americans today than Canada's ever been.
Absolutely.
The frustration level. Try and imagine what it took to create
COVID. COVID brought the cold that was civil unrest in America has now gone north of the border. There's no doubt about it. We've COVID and the distrust in that and the distrust in the media of those things and the way that we handled certain things, the way we shut down certain businesses created much more of a liberal conservative kind of divide. There's no doubt about that.
And we have to be careful because I tell you, Canada is in a position where if the wrong person if you get a really charismatic,
I'd argue we're already there.
Wow. You know,
I mean, you don't have to say it, but I will. I'd argue we're already there. We've got a very charismatic person who's making deals with other political parties, and who the second anybody, you know, we stand for the freedom of Indian farmers, but the second the truckers said anything, all of a sudden they never even talked to them, called people names, whatever. Look, vaccinated, unvaccinated. This wasn't about that. It was about people feeling frustrated, it was everyday Canadians. Okay,
Think about this. They let that go on
for weeks.
Till the fight became between common citizens.
Yeah.
And in other words, politicians didn't intervene except for handing out donuts at a certain point, but let Canadians fight each other. And I'm sitting there and I go, but why did we get to this? How did somebody not get out of their house, take a walk there with a few
It's because he had COVID. He had COVID. Yeah. We shy away from the real conversation over and over and over again. And then all they did is just show up and parrot the same message over and over and over again. And every time he was asked a question from the conservative side of the aisle, and again, I'm not fighting for conservatives this way or the other way. I'm leaning more conservative these days, I'll say that. Although I voted for Trudeau years ago, I'll say the idea is I can't believe that somebody can ask a direct question of a politician in Canada, and that person completely ignores the question four times, just parroting their line. It's like Donald Trump. It's exactly the same thing, just saying, we're going to build a wall. We're going to build back, make America great. It's the same thing. Now, one happened to be more bullyish and right side of the aisle. Now this one's more on the liberal side of the aisle, and Canada's always leaned left, okay? As much as we have a right, we're always leaned left. We're conservative in some ways, but we're very liberal in most ways. And I love that. I love that about Canada. I love that we have, you know, a liberal mindset around so much stuff, and particularly related to civil rights of every kind, you know, gay rights, whatever.
Canadians are less to the extreme poles.
Absolutely. But we're becoming, right? That's starting to happen. Those poles are definitely changing. They're definitely changing. Yeah. And we're in a scenario where where the zig and the zag that I was talking about, I guess, is happening in more and more and more and more extremes. And we're worried now, like when I see them shutting down bank accounts, when I see them talking about rolling out a digital ID for absolutely everything, they're going to troll everything, everything's going to be one place. People are going to start to say, well, you know what? I don't know if I trust the Canadian dollar anymore. I don't trust the US dollar. We're seeing now I think in the world order, we're seeing China rise inevitably. We're seeing, you know, deals that are going to be done in yuans versus dollars, particularly in oil. So we're in a precarious scenario. We're in a time where we need to have better leadership, and we need leadership that is uniting us. And I think Trudeau had done a good job at uniting us at one point. I really do. And I have to give him that credit, but I can't say that that's true now. I can't say that that feels true in the streets of Montreal, nor does it feel true in the streets of Vancouver. I just think that we are in a scenario where we need more private equity leader. Like, we need more people like you, dragons, investing in real life solutions. And solutions that are, yes, economically viable, but also long-term thinking solutions that maybe pay off over time, right? That maybe have a larger perspective on life.
Think about this, right? If somebody like me would go out and say, Canada should be pumping out twice the amount of oil it's pumping out, on social media, I'd get a few trolls here and there, call me all kinds of names.
You'd slate.
Elon Musk says, so the number one battery electric power guy.
He says we have to pump more oil.
Hey, we need more oil. And everybody just doesn't say a word. Everybody. Right. So
it's because he had the brand where he did the other thing, which is fair. And he did a fucking phenomenal job doing that.
But the key is people need to understand that 50 Shades of Grey isn't a book. It's the reality of things. It's well not said. Black or white. Yep. It's a whole bunch of shades from one spectrum to the other, and we don't all fit in the same, and there's got to be a middle ground for everybody. And you cannot dehumanize people. You cannot expect people to care more about somebody they don't know than about themselves. It's not human. Right? So you need to get humanity more educated, asking more questions. Because the truth of the matter is, when we speak and we argue and we ask questions, we learn. We don't only convince somebody else that we're right, we actually maybe learn something. And as we're arguing, we're both learning and we're both finding a middle ground somewhere where we're going to get along. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, if you look at the Ukraine situation, it's a bit of an awkward thing, right? I mean,
it's definitely awkward.
I mean, come on. The U.S. pretty much manipulated the Ukraine, had them at the doorsteps of NATO, but because they didn't sign in, sorry, we can't help you. But you got me in trouble. You're the one who got me into this fight with Putin. Mm-hmm. And now what do you think? You're just walking away? Come on.
But it's an impossible situation. How do you help them and how do you not, right? And there's no right answer to it. It's impossible not to help them, and it's impossible to help them in this capacity. But we could have seen it coming, and he gave us all the signs. He told you, like, hey, don't do that. You know what I mean? Like, we do have to listen here and there. And I think that you're right. We're not asking the right questions. We're not approaching it, you know, with a real world scenario. And when you can just print money out of nowhere, or you could just do anything without any checks and balances, unlike the real world, unlike the real market, where I can't just spend on my credit card until forever and then not have consequences about it. We do need better fundamental economics and better fundamental ways. Like, I believe that politicians should have to show a budget first before getting elected properly, and then if they don't run the budget in a particular way, they get fired. Literally, like, forget an election, they get fired based on that.
I mean, just like you would as a CEO. When I'm asked forecasts every year,
yeah,
at the end of the year when I give in my financial statements, I have guys who tell me, "But how come you didn't meet your numbers? What happened? Explain to me why you were off on your forecast." When the government does a budget and they're off, who cares?
Nobody cares. Yeah, because there's no consequence.
Somebody else's money, right? Because the idea is it's somebody else's money. No. It's your money, right? And that's where ultimately, like I said, we need to ask more questions. We need to demand better from our leaders. Mm-hmm. And we need to stop the shaming where we're not allowed to ask questions. Why?
Not allowed to ask questions. We're not allowed to be wrong. We're not allowed to say the wrong thing. We're not allowed to say, I don't know. We have a culture where we're not allowed to say, I don't know. Guzzo, I deeply appreciate your energy. I appreciate your perspective. I can see why you're considering running, and I understand that you maybe want to get your affairs more in order before you make that move. I love the energy you've brought to Montreal. Love that you have dedicated yourself to this town and constantly put time, money, energy, your dollars to work here in this city. And honored for the work that you've done and really excited to see more of, like, some of the investments, some of the things that you're doing on Dragon's Den. I would love to invite you out to my farm at some point, by the way. You should definitely come for...
I'd love to come.
Yeah, farm table dinners. We're bringing in pizza ovens. Anyway, all stuff that I absolutely know you love. It's 20 minutes away on the South Shore of Montreal. So anything you want to leave people with? Any final words, predictions, anything like that?
Like I said, ask more questions.
Beautiful.
Demand answers. You're allowed. That's what the people should do.
Great advice. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, guys.
You guys know where the buttons are, the like, subscribe, all that kind of stuff. Make sure to hit those and leave comments. Leave comments. It's always helpful. Every time you click, it is always super helpful. And stay tuned for the next episode.